Welcome back to the wonderful world of Bakeology. I'm your host, Adam Miller, and I'm joined this week by journalist and food critic Cara Monson to explore how food shapes who we are with a no soggy bottom guarantee. The art of writing and describing food has always fascinated me. I'm in constant awe of anyone whose job it is to describe what's arguably one of the most subjective experiences there is, the act of eating and tasting. So I'm so excited to be chatting with Cara today. And not only will this conversation be positively overflowing with vivid descriptions of baking and food, I'm excited to uncover how Cara approaches her job as a food writer and critic and why she is so drawn to food as a career. And Cara's also chosen some mouth-watering bakes to discuss that are the exemplification of how food shapes who we are. So prepare yourself for a mouth-watering hour of discussion. Cara, welcome to Bakeology. Thank you so much for having me in your glorious kitchen.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. This is such a pleasure.
I'm so excited to chat to you today. I've been looking forward to this recording all week, especially since I saw you were baking some stuff
yes.
a couple of days ago, which
yes,
looked incredible. And walking into this house, the smell.
Oh, yeah. I know. We need like smell-o-vision, don't we?
It is insane, the smell. I won't give it away yet,
okay.
What you've made, but there's definitely something to look forward to there. Before we get into that delicious food, I wanted to ask you why you love food so much. You're a journalist and a food and a wine critic with the mission of finding the delicious in the everyday.
Yes.
Why were you drawn to food journalism?
So I have always been passionate about writing and about food.
Mm.
And it was, I think, you know, just recently within the last 5 years, it's really come to fruition because I was so determined to be a news journalist. And
yeah.
that was my overarching passion when I was in high school. I was so determined to like, you know, break the news and get those juicy, you know, hard-hitting stories, be on the front page. And when I was 25, after working for a number of years in the regions and in suburban papers, I finally got my dream job, which was at the Herald Sun and writing breaking news and writing about crime and all these, you know, really in-depth, heavy topics. Mm. But it was only when I suppose you do that for so long, you have to take a break because it is mentally...
It's intense, right?
It's intense. And, you know, I feel like I had the reputation of being the stakeout queen, which for those who aren't in media, staking out is being at a crime scene or being at someone's house and waiting for that AFL footballer to walk out of their house so you can grab the first quote from them. It was like that.
And so you'd spend the whole day...
Yeah.
Or a lot of the day.
The whole day.
Yeah. Wow.
And usually you couldn't leave until the TV news was finished because you just don't know what they're going to have. So it was just being there and on all the time and dealing with some pretty heavy topics too. Like, you know, when people die or people are murdered, it's a lot. So after doing that for so many years, I thought, okay, well, what else do I love? What else am I passionate about? And it always came back to food. It always came back to food. So after doing a few videos, I was doing a lot of social media content for the Herald Sun and...
Around food?
Around food, yeah. I'd go to shopping centres. One of my early series at the Herald Sun was called Eating My Way Around. And I was very strategic about how I did that because I thought... All right, I want to go out of the office. I don't want to go and report on heavy hitting news, but I want to eat.
Yeah.
So maybe I could cover all these events in Melbourne and write about food.
Yeah.
So I thought, genius, right? This is a great idea.
Love it.
So we ended up doing Eating My Way Around shopping centres, started, you know, go to Chadstone or go to High Point or Eastland and go to a few different restaurants there. Then that progressed into eating at festivals, so like Moomba or Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
Yeah, amazing.
So, and then eventually that caught the eye of our food editor at the time who said, do you want to write about restaurants? Do you want to be a food critic?
Yeah, wow.
And I thought, oh, okay. I've never thought of myself as a critic.
How cool.
But I do love eating. I am that Labrador. So let's try that. And yeah, I guess the rest is history. I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah. So you trained in journalism.
Yes.
But did you do any professional, like, I don't even know if there is. Is there like a professional like training to be a food critic, or is it just something that you sort of teach yourself, as odd as that sounds to us?
Well, you do have to learn on the job, and I know learning on the job for this gig is just a lot of eating and a lot of thinking about it too, because I think when we do eat and we're loving you know, this apple pie, or we're loving this cake or curry or whatever it is, we're not thinking about, well, maybe people are, but I certainly wasn't thinking about how should this taste? What feeling should I be getting from this?
Yes.
What is the, and I know this is getting a bit airy fairy, so you can
no, I love it.
You can write me off here, but you know, what is the story that the chef or the cook is trying to tell through this bake or through this dish? And I think when you start looking at food like that, that's when you can start describing it in ways, which I think you were alluding to before, where how do you start thinking and writing about food?
Yeah.
And let me set the record straight. When I first started out, I was not very good at it, and I did have to learn how to rewire my brain, how to write about food, because it is a skill and it is something you have to learn and just practice.
Yeah. So where do you go to learn it? Like, do you read a lot of other food critics? Yeah, how do you go about
that? Yeah, it is a lot of reading, and it's reading everything. It's reading, you know, the New York Times critics, like Pete Wells, writing. It's reading Gourmet Traveler. It's reading Good Food. It's reading Delicious, you know, reading other critics in your organization's work, and even just reading in general, like reading fiction and reading how authors string together words. And I think my ethos and what I sort of want to sort of put to people, it's finding the delicious in every day, but it's also making that accessible, because I think with food, we can make it a little bit wanky. Like,
yes.
We can make it a little bit snooty and snobby. And
it takes the enjoyment out, I think, when you do that.
And it makes it pretentious.
Yeah,
and
food's not elitist.
No. And then if we go to wine, that is a completely different ballgame, because wine is even higher up the chain in terms of elitism and snobbery, because people, you know, like, you can go really down a rabbit hole with wine.
Yes.
So it's, I just want to make people not, I want it to make approachable, and I want to sort of be able to communicate with people in a way that isn't scary, that isn't snooty, and that people can think, oh yeah, when I eat this tart, it does taste like a mango Wheat bar.
Yes.
Or it tastes like a Snicker, or you know what I mean? There's sort of that relevance and familiarity with it.
So building on that, like, describing the taste and texture of food, it's something really hard to do, because obviously taste and texture is quite a personal experience, and food is often always, I think, quite subjective. In the preambles for my recipes, I try and do a little bit of, not food critiquing, but describing what to look for, how it tastes at the end, trying to describe that in quite a descriptive, colorful way. You do it very well.
Oh, thank you.
And you kind of touched on it there, but like, if, how do you do it? Like, if you're sitting down for a chicken parma, what goes through your mind when you're eating it? And then how do you take that experience and put it onto paper?
With that, it's thinking, and perhaps whatever comes to your mind first, writing that down. So I know, I feel like I touched on it earlier, but, and I know it sounds easier said than done, but it's really just about eating something and then thinking and describing how that should, what you taste. And it is personable, and it is subjective. So we might be eating the same chicken parma, and I think, this reminds me of driving down a dirt road and it's all rubbly and you've got this really textural crumb, but then you've got this juiciness that's seeping through the chicken.
Yeah.
But then you've got this, you know, luscious velvety red sauce that's been sort of smothered on top. And then you've got this cheese just sort of sweating down the parma.
Yes. Sweating. I love that.
So it could, very unsexy word. Apparently there are sexy words and unsexy words when it comes to writing about food. Like moist, I don't know, jury's out on that one. Do we use that one to describe how a dessert feels?
Yes, I think so. Like a cake. Yeah. Like always. Yes. A moist cake. That's a big tick in my book.
Okay. Is it squishy though?
Happy with squishy as well.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, how else would you describe a cake.
Like a wet cake.
Wet.
Wet? That seems like a sad word. We don't want to use
like,
wet.
Oh, that's a wet cake. But a moist cake, yes.
Yes.
I'll have an extra slice.
Yes. But it's really thinking about words that I guess what I'm trying to do is always thinking about how can I say this in a way that everyone will understand, but I haven't said it before and other people haven't said it that way either.
Mm.
So when you're reading a review, what makes it Cara or what makes it Adam or what makes it Nigella or what makes it, Adam Liao? Like it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
How is this me and how can I tell this in my words to someone?
Mm. We're going to put that to the test right now.
Oh, God.
All right. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Yes.
Throw out some common foods that I think almost every listener will know and ask you to describe them for me. Are you ready for this?
Okay, I'm ready.
I know this is an early challenge.
Yes.
We'll start easy. Vegemite.
Ooh. Salty umami spread.
I think that's pretty good. throw in yeasty and I think...
Yeah.
Although, as you said, yeasty is used all the time.
Yeah, so. And it's also a bit unsexy.
It is.
I don't feel like I've ever used yeasty in a really nice romantic way. But
no, there's a challenge for you.
Okay, I'll figure out that one.
Vanilla slice in the news at the moment because they just crowned Australia's best. Describe a vanilla slice.
It is a jiggly.
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 I love it.
Jiggly sugar fudge. Jiggly fudge.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got that jiggle, it's got the fudge.
Yeah. What about, this is going off describing it, but your ideal vanilla slice, icing sugar on the top or the white royal-ish icing?
Ooh. Ah. Oh. Mm.
I mean, it could be pink as well, I guess.
I think you need the icing.
Yeah,
I agree.
You
need the icing because then it's kind of like milfoy, isn't it? If it's sort of just like custard or cream layered between the pastry.
Yeah.
Like I think you need, and then it gets a little bit, on your snout and a bit, dusty. And
you need it to like, it gets sticky. Like when you go in to bite it, you get it on your fingers.
Yeah.
It's like part of the whole experience of the vanilla slice.
Yeah, that's it. And I guess also just as a side note, like with food, with food writing in particular, you're trying to make people feel something.
Mm.
I think with journalism, and this is probably where it was really hard for me, was to try and, like with news journalism, you're trying to say, this is what happened in the least amount of words in the most direct way.
Mm.
Whereas food writing, it's about that journey. It's taking people on that journey. I know that that's a bit of another wanky, snooty term, but it's trying to get people on this journey of like experience. Like I wasn't there to eat the vanilla slice. So tell me, Cara, how did it taste?
Mm.
Was it jiggly? Did you get stuff on your snout? Did it make a mess on your fingers?
Mm.
It's that. It's trying to get people to feel something.
The whole thing. Yeah.
It's evocative.
Yeah. Love it. I've got two more for you.
Okay.
A warm chocolate pudding.
Oh, it's kind of like slipping into like a hot bath, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like a great hot pudding is just like, I'm just picturing slipping into like a hot spring sort of bath. But it's luscious and there's velvety. It's kind of like molten and rich.
Love it.
Yeah.
And a big finish.
Okay.
The Hawaiian pizza.
Oh, I love Hawaiian pizza.
Thank you. That's so good.
I was listening to your podcast. I think it was, I can't remember whether it was with Cal Wilson or Darren Purchase, but it was about the need to have that sweetness in it.
Yes.
The salty sweet.
It was Darren.
Yeah, Darren. Yep. Yeah, there we go. I knew he's a good bloke.
Yes.
How would I describe it? Okay.
Well, maybe just pizza in general, not necessarily just Hawaiian, but like any pizza.
I think a great pizza needs to have very crisp bottom, but not too thick.
Oh, I don't know why I giggled.
Yeah, bottom. It's a very proper word. I don't know whether it's a sexy or unsexy word. Crisp bottom. But then you've got that cushiness. There's a cushy squishiness to a pizza, which is, I think the chew is important.
I
with
love the
base.
Chew on the crust.
Yeah, on the
particularly
crust.
Particularly
wood
fired.
Yeah. Mm. And tickle of burnt, a little burnt bitterness. Just tickled, slightly tickled. And then I reckon we could go like with the ham, or I guess it's like how are they using it? Is it sheets of ham? is it like sheets that are so fine that it's sort of melting and it's salty, and then you've got like those thick hunks of pineapple, which are kind of like a lolly in a way. It's like nature's candy on a pizza.
So good.
Yeah.
Oh
man, we need to get pizza now.
I know. Oh, give me pizza. Yes. I've not had a Hawaiian in a long time.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I know. Maybe that's dinner tonight.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes, sorted.
Before we get into the food and the bakes that you've listed out here, you're also an event host and an MC.
Yes.
And you have lived one of my dreams, which is meeting Nigella Lawson.
Oh my goodness.
Can you tell me about that?
That is still a very big pinch me moment.
Yeah, I
feel like when I'm having a bad day, I'm like, I haven't achieved anything in life. I go, oh, no, I met Nigella.
Mm.
So that I am honestly, truly blessed to have been asked to host that event with Lexus Australia at Point Leo Estate.
Mm.
Nigella Lawson is an absolute queen and an undeniable lover and appreciator of food.
Mm.
And when I was talking earlier about being food obsessed, she is genuinely food obsessed.
Yeah.
She just oozes or exudes a passion for baking and cooking.
Mm.
And she really wants everyone else to, I suppose, drink in that passion.
Yes.
And she's genuinely such a lovely person who is very down to earth.
Mm.
And for the very short time, I feel like there's so many other people in this world that have spent so much longer with Nigella and worked with her. But for the very short time that I was with her, I just was able to sort of feel that in her presence.
Mm.
And she's just so kind and generous with her time and genuinely wants people to eat well and drink well.
Yeah. Her writing is incredible. Was she one of the influences for your food writing?
Yeah, she very early on, and I would say even presenting too, with Nigella. I grew up watching Nigella.
Yeah, same.
And loved her. And I thought she was such an absolute, goddess in the kitchen. I think beautiful inside and out. And I really feel like she's been able to connect with people on a different level when it comes to presenting, and especially with her food writing.
Mm.
And there's an intelligence there, and also just an intelligence, and I don't know how to describe it, but it's just this warmth.
Yes, and I love the air of campness about it all. It never takes it too seriously.
No.
And is there because she loves it, not because she's trying to lord over someone or...
Of course.
Yeah.
And I think that's that's what baking and cooking is about. It's about having fun, and you can make mistakes, and that's all a part of learning.
Mm.
So, yeah, Nigella, an absolute gorgeous human.
You've given us the perfect segue into your first bake, I think. And I love that you've cryptically named it The Great Baking Disaster of 2005.
The Great Baking Disaster. Oh my goodness.
Can you describe this disaster and the bake that we're subsequently talking about?
So this is a sad story with a funny ending.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2005, my pop passed away almost 20 years ago now, which is scary.
Scary to think about.
How long ago that was. But it was the first big death in our family. And as all families do, when we're mourning, we all come under the one roof and people spend time together. And my sister and I thought, let's try and cheer people up. Let's do something to make people smile again. So we decided to bake some cupcakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be, without rhyme or reason, a little bit fast and loose when it comes to certain things in life. And we were in the kitchen and we had a recipe. We were following it to a T, but we got to the step with bicarb. And I thought, we'll just put it like a cup in there. That'll be fine.
A cup of bicarb.
Yeah.
Oh.
Anyway, and I had obviously never baked before.
How old were you?
50.
Okay, great.
Yes, unashamedly a teenager who should have known better, but...
Oh, no.
You know, you got to live a little.
Yeah.
So we ended up baking these cupcakes and they rose like absolute champs. They were so tall, so fluffy, looked incredible. We piped them with this vanilla frosting did the swirl and everything. Mm. They just looked great. And we brought them into the living room where everyone was and we're like, we've made some cupcakes. And everyone grabbed one and then we just promptly left the room and did the washing up.
Yeah.
Came back and I was like, what did everyone think? And I just looked and it was, everyone was just really quiet. And I looked at my uncle and my uncle's looking at me and he just proceeds to lift up the little plate that I'd served it on and it had one bite out of it. Uh-huh. And he just looked at me. He's like, did you taste these before you served them? And I said, no, I didn't. And then looked over at Nan and Nan had eaten the whole thing. And I was like, what's wrong? And he's like, it tastes like dishwater. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, it tastes like you've put too much like baking powder in this. And I did, I think, you know, bless Nan, you know, Nan for eating the whole thing.
Nan ate the whole thing.
I know, bless her. She's like, I didn't want to hurt your feelings. Oh. And I was like, oh gosh. So ended up having one. I think out of spite, I ate a whole one. I was like, yeah, it wasn't too bad, but it was terrible.
Is that memory of that taste seared in your mind?
It's seared in my mind, but it also gets brought up at every family event. And my uncle even said, I think it was a few months ago, he's like, I find it so ironic now that you're in a food role. And I'm like, well, there we go. I guess anything can happen.
Look, we learn from our mistakes.
We do learn from our mistakes. So to answer your question, the bake, I think I called it, I sent it to you, called the Great Baking Disaster of 2005.
You did.
But on Instagram, I called it my redemption bake because I guess I wanted to sort of prove to myself that, yes, I could bake it. And I did bake it.
And you gave them a glow up.
Yeah, they looked great. Yeah, I thought they looked pretty good.
And there was limoncello in there, if memory serves.
There was limoncello. That was like a sneaky ode to your time on Bake Off.
Oh, because boozy bakes.
Yeah, you do boozy bakes. You do them well. So I was like, I've definitely got a lot of booze in this house. Mm-hmm. So let's make a booze-inspired icing. And they were very well received by the Monson household.
Oh, they looked incredible.
Oh, thank you.
Have you had any other baking disasters?
Not that I can remember. Nowhere near that great baking disaster of 2005.
Yeah. You peaked.
I peaked. I got to peak early.
Yeah. The worst one I've done in a similar vein was I was making like a tomato tartatin. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like confit the tomatoes, spent like hours preparing them and then was doing the dough. We didn't have any flour. So Nick went out, bought some flour from the shop down the road. And then I was making it. Didn't look at the box because we couldn't get the normal sort of brand of flour that we used. And I'm making the dough. I'm like, this is really dry. Like, this is very odd. But I'll just put more water in. And it eventually came together. I was rolling it out. This is rough puff. So it took a little while.
Yeah.
I'm like, this doesn't feel quite right. And this is a lesson that I learned then and at Bake Off is always trust your gut. If it's not right, it generally isn't.
Yes.
Rolled it out, put it on these gorgeous tomatoes, baked it. And about 3 minutes in, it just was disintegrating. Just imagine the world crumbling during a sinkhole event. Just, yes. I looked at the box. It was gluten-free flour.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness.
I'd spent so long on this and it was going to be lunch. It was like the centerpiece of this lunch we were going to have. It was like a spring day picnic. So good.
Oh, no.
It was ruined.
Lunch was ruined.
We didn't even bother tasting it.
Oh, no.
In the bin.
Straight in the bin. Oh, goodness. Hey, we've all been there.
Yes.
And you have learned. You have learned.
Read the box.
I've learned to read the recipe. Recipes, I feel like they're not my friends sometimes.
So you eat and write about food for a living. Do you still find pleasure in cooking and baking?
I love it. Mm. It is my love language. I jump at a chance to bake something or cook something for someone. And I think there definitely is a moment when you are a food critic where going out for dinner becomes a bit like a job. Mm. And I've definitely seen that in my side of work. But if you truly love something, you're never working a day in your life. Yeah. So I definitely have those moments where with baking, I could, depending on how much time I have, I feel like I'm so time poor. But if I've got time to make like a really nice ragu and some pasta from scratch, like on New Year's Eve, that's we didn't do anything. And I said, I'm going to bake. Just going to bake some pasta for dinner. So I ended up making the pasta from scratch and we made these like prawn ravioli and it was just in a burnt butter and sage sauce. So quite simple. But I just can't imagine not doing that. Mm.
So the joy is still there.
Yeah, lots of joy, lots of love.
Amazing. You touched on it just then when you go out, not to critique somewhere, but just going out with family or your husband. Can you switch it off?
Yes and no, you can. It's one of those things, it's like a superpower where you're constantly thinking about how does this taste? Is this right? Do I enjoy this? Even with wine, I do it with wine. I can't switch that off. Mm. Like every glass of wine I get. And if I don't like it, I won't drink it or eat it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely that element there for sure.
Mm. We're going to move on to your second bake now.
Okay, second bake.
And I love a food fight, and this is the battle of the apple pies.
It is a battle of the apple pies.
It's your mum versus your granny.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about their respective apple pies.
Yes. So I only learnt this week when I was doing my research about this bake.
Mm.
But this is the same recipe too. So
they both use the same one.
They both use the same one. Interesting. But they have different ways to apply it. So mum, we'll start with Gran because Gran had the mm-hmm. original recipe. But it's an apple pie that uses a lot more sugar than my mum's.
In the pastry or the apples or both?
Both.
Okay.
Yes. So it's an apple pie recipe that I'm not too sure where Gran actually got it from, but she would make it when we would go over to her house when we were kids.
Mm.
And she would make it in this like glass tray that was kind of like a lasagna tray.
Yep.
So and it was big. And mum comes from a big family. My gran's Ukrainian. So she has this, I think she has 7 brothers and sisters, mum. And I guess, you know, when you have that big lasagna tray, you got to feed the family.
Yes.
So she would make this apple pie that the recipe actually is 1 cup of self-raising flour, 1 cup of plain, 1/2 cup of raw sugar, has to be raw sugar, and 1/2 cup of butter. And you'd make that into a dough. You can use milk to make it a bit wetter, ugly word, to wetten it. And then you're making it into a dough. You let it rest for only 20 minutes in the fridge. And mum said 5. And I'm like, oh, geez, that's not long. 20 minutes in the fridge, roll it out. With the apples, you're cutting them up into chunks.
Mm-hmm.
I think what Gran does is she lets it boil down so they're all mushy.
Yep.
And she puts sugar in that apple pie mixture too. Mm-hmm. And then she'll put it into, she'll line the lasagna tray with the thick pastry.
Mm.
And then she will put in the apples and then she'll sort of top it off with a thick sort of like lid. And
yes.
then she'll sprinkle that with sugar and then she'll bake it. And it does get a soggy bottom, which we don't like soggy bottoms. We have learned soggy bottoms are bad. So it does have a soggy bottom, but it's really nice because I have these memories of going to her house during the day and she'd made it like at lunchtime and it was sitting under a tea towel and you'd sort of just peek under the tea towel and sneak a little bit because, you know, why not? And it was just so fresh and just been baked and a little bit warm and it was just delicious. Like, it was so good.
Do you know what? On the soggy bottom,
yes.
I know, like, you don't want a soggy bottom on a pie, but I've got to say, for me, sometimes the best part of a pie is that little bit of pastry that isn't cooked.
Yes.
It's like the raw bit.
Too. Yeah.
That's, for me, one of the joys of a pie. And
yes.
if the bottom of a pie is like that and it's in a container, I think that's fine.
Yeah. No, I enjoy that. So there's that. And it's sweet when you eat it too. It's like, and you have this big boulder of ice cream on top.
Mm.
So it's just, I love that. But with mums, mum actually chooses to go down a bit more of a savory, less sweet route.
Mm-hmm.
So she's using the same recipe to make it. You have to put sugar in the pastry. So I learnt today when I used the wrong sugar and mum was telling me off saying, you've got to use the raw sugar. And I'm like, I use brown sugar. And
mum knows best.
I was like, mum, I don't want to. So I ended up remaking a pie, which, spoiler alert, I have made for you today, Adam.
Yes, it's on the bench.
Yes.
And the smell is just wafting through this house.
Oh, man. It's good. I can't wait to eat it.
Why it's not sitting here, I don't know.
Anyway, so she makes this apple pie. She actually doesn't put all the apples into the apple pie mixture when she's cooking it down on the stove. She has 1/2 of them raw and then 1/2 of them cooked. They mix that up together and that's your base. You can put sugar in it if you'd like. I did because I do like a little bit of sugar in there, but she doesn't. She just uses the natural sugars that are in the apples.
Yep.
And then she uses that in a round tray, 23 centimeters diameter, I've been told.
Yeah.
That was on the recipe.
Very precise.
Yes, very precise. And yeah, then she bakes it in the oven. And when you put the lid on, it's a little bit thinner than the bottom. So the bottom's thicker, lid's thin. You've got to slick it with some milk, and then you put the raw sugar on top.
On the top.
Of the pastry. The,
yes. Yep.
And then you bake for 30 minutes. Mm. So that's her recipe. So and I appreciated both of the bakes. I like Gran's for its sweetness and sogginess and snatchability, where you just snatch it from under the tea towel. Yes. But then with Mum's, I appreciate the texture, because I'm a texture fiend when it comes to desserts. Love it.
Yes. And the tip of not cooking all the apple, some of the apple still has the crunch after you've baked it. I learned that when I was practicing a pie for bake-off, coincidentally enough. So good.
I love that.
Yes. It's a great tip.
It's a good hack.
Are there any other bakes that your mum or your granny made that you cherish as much as the pie?
Granny was very good at making donuts.
Oh.
Hot donuts. So she would make these kind of like when you go to the show, or like I'm thinking Queen Vic Market, but they're not filled. They're just fat round donuts with the ring in the middle. And
with the ring.
Yeah, so like the Homer Simpson donut with the ring.
So not a hot jam.
No, no full. Hot jam with the ring. And they were chubby donuts with this beautiful bounciness to them when you bit into them. And we did actually recreate these in lockdown, because like everyone, and I assume you would have been the same, we all got a bit baking obsessed.
Yes.
And I made friends with yeast. An ugly
there
word.
It is.
The ugly
there
word. Is. Yeast. made friends with yeast because I could trust it. Again, I feel like I've had moments where I'm baking and I feel like I don't trust it, but I figured it out in lockdown. So we made these donuts, and they were just great. They were very filling because they're so large, but I think that's the beauty of them. You've got to get them straight out of the fryer.
Yes.
You've got to let them rise so they're so fat. And then
Do you cover them, or did your granny cover them in sugar and cinnamon, or?
Sugar.
Sugar.
Just sugar. And it wasn't even caster sugar. I think it was just like a normal granule sugar.
It gives you a nice crunch.
I liked the crunch. It was good.
I think is it granule sugar?
Granule
or,
sugar.
Or non-granulated sugar? I don't know.
It's not caster sugar, but it's the other one.
The chunk, the bigger one, the
OG,
chunky one.
The OG sugar.
What you put in your tea.
Yeah, that one.
Should you need a sweetener.
Of course. That one.
That's. I don't think that sugar's used enough.
Underrated
for
sugar.
For the texture.
It's like, rank your sugars. What's the best sugar? Is it caster sugar? Is it raw sugar?
It's brown for me.
Brown.
Dark brown.
Ooh, dark brown. Mm. I like that. Mm-hmm. It's good.
Yes, particularly in a chocolate chip cookie. Dark brown.
So good. I love that. What about icing sugar? I feel like that's an unsung hero.
Icing sugar hides a multitude of sins. If a bake hasn't gone quite as you'd hoped, dust that baby in icing sugar.
Oh my goodness.
That's all you need.
I'm getting crime scene analogies here. It's like, oh, just sprinkle a little bit of icing sugar here.
It's literally all you need. For your final bake, we're going to an all-time classic, the lemon tart.
Lemon tart. This is a little bit of a sentimental story for my love, my husband, Luke. I started dating Luke the week before his birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're starting a new relationship, I guess you don't ask them. Well, I certainly didn't. When's your birthday?
Mm-hmm.
So we got together and then it came up in conversation that it was his birthday the following week.
Yep.
And I was thinking, my goodness, what do I get someone who I've just started dating, who I obviously like a lot, but don't want to be that person to be like, I got you a watch, or I got you a car, I got you something really
grandiose.
Big. Yeah. Mm. So because I have a love language that is food, and I love cooking and baking for people, I decided to bake him his favorite tart, which was a lemon tart. And to be honest, I don't think I'd actually baked one before that moment. So that was a test for me to try and get it right.
It's not an easy thing to get right.
It's not. And I have eaten my fair share of lemon tarts in this job over the years. And I do have some favorites, so I'm happy to share that list with you later. But yeah, it was definitely one of those bakes that I don't even remember what recipe I used. I feel like it was a short crust recipe that perhaps Mum's, maybe one that I just like a basic short crust recipe.
That's all you need.
And I think the hardest trick was making sure you could extract the yolk from the whites to have the egg yolk and not have any straddly white bits in it, and then to be able to mix that without curdling. Mm-hmm. I think that's a skill.
It is a skill.
And I have made in lockdown as well, definitely had a good crack at lemon curd, and I feel like I can do lemon curd.
Now. I love lemon curd. I've been obsessed with lemon curd this summer.
It's so good.
I've come up with my own cracking recipe. Find it online.
Yes, I'm going to search it.
And so I think I've made probably 10 to 12 jars.
The best.
Like I get someone at work gives me lemons.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. I love it. There's always that, like that jar of sunshine in my fridge. But do you know what? This isn't the word of a lie.
Okay.
I did exactly the same thing.
Yes.
For Nick.
Really?
We met during COVID at the end of August 2020 and his birthday is in the start of October. So there's a little bit of a gap. A
bit more of a gap.
But it was, cast your mind back for those that were in Melbourne, we weren't allowed to go further than 5 kilometres.
Oh my goodness. And we were not.
I know, it's triggering. But yes. We were just outside of that. So we had a crossover at like the Botanical Gardens and a few other places.
Oh, nice.
So our first little while was always just walking around the park.
Yeah.
It got to his birthday and he didn't want a cake. And I'm like, similar to you. I'm like, I don't know. Like, what do I,
what
like
do
we've
you
just
do?
Started.
Yeah.
And so I did the lemon tart from scratch. And that was the first time that I crossed the 5 kilometre boundary and delivered the lemon tart. And, and the rest is history.
Like, wow. I feel like we're onto something here. Maybe there is something in, like, there's a correlation between relationships and longevity and lemon tart.
And lemon tart.
There
I think
go.
So.
It
shows skill.
Yes.
And it shows, I think, a dedication.
Mm-hmm. And commitment. And
yeah. You're putting yourself out there with a lemon tart.
There's a risk.
There's a big risk.
Yeah.
Why do you think the tart is so enduring, the lemon tart? What is it that makes it so
beautiful?
Yeah.
I love the, there's that beautiful magic between tartness, sweetness. It's the texture.
It's like, so smooth.
It's, well, I would say smooth. It's like, oh, maybe that's a banned word because it is smooth. But is it, what makes a great lemon tart? Is it the jiggle? I feel like you do need a little bit of jiggle in
like
there.
Like a fishtail when you cut the wedge.
Yes, you need that fishtail. Sweeping motion. And you want it to cut like butter when you cut into the curd bit. But then you want to hit this sort of crumbly, buttery sort of ground that's, it's like you're digging through it and it's sort of like a mission.
You want to hear that
yeah.
of the knife. Like
you do need that.
You need the force, but then you want it to, I don't know what the word is. What am I looking for there?
Sort
you
of
want
that
it to,
rupture, that sort of the jolt.
Jolt. That's a good word.
The contrast between butter soft and crumbly, rubbly butter. Yeah, you need that.
Can a lemon tart be improved with meringue?
Ooh. I want it naked. I want it to be.
I'm the same. Yeah. I don't think you need it.
I think meringue is great and it has its place, but there are so many avenues to get it wrong too. So maybe we just don't overdo it. Some people do it very well and I appreciate that, but maybe we just stick to the original. Yeah. Let's just stick to the script.
I think so. I mean, I appreciate that you use it because you need to use the egg whites. So there's a non-wastage thing there, but just make something else with the egg whites.
You could make like meringue kisses.
Mm-hmm. Or like amaretti.
Yes, absolutely.
Just get some almond flour and mix those together.
I love that. And yeah, you could definitely do that.
You can have that the next day.
Absolutely. It's all about being inventive and we're all about no waste and reusing as much as we can. So I like that challenge. That's great.
It's all very inspiring here.
It is. I know. We're inspiring your next bag.
It's time for your final course.
Oh, yes.
Which,
I'm
as
ready.
It comes with two helpings, as always. The first serve comes in the form of a question.
Yes.
Sent from a listener, a fellow bakeologist. Yes, put the call out.
And we've got goodness.
We had some questions come in.
People have some questions.
They do. Fantastic.
I love this.
This one comes from Marcus in Sydney. Hi, Marcus.
Hello, Marcus.
Who asks, if you could interview anyone in the food world, who would it be?
Oh, my gosh. It is so tricky.
Mm.
I was going to say Nigella, but that happened.
That's done. Tick.
Tick.
Where do you go from there?
Where do I go from there? Initially, we're talking, I'm thinking the heavy hitters, like your Rick Steins and your Jamie Olivers. But I also really get a kick out of interviewing the up-and-coming people, the everyday chefs, And I just want to know a little bit more about what makes them tick.
Mm.
Why are they so passionate? Because if you think about being a chef or a baker, it is so difficult.
Yeah.
And you have to. It's a career that's purely ignited by this passion mm-hmm. that you have for baking. And it's not like, maybe it is like if you're a lawyer or you're an economist or you're in an engineer and you know, a science-based sort of field, where I don't know whether they share that similar passion, but with creative industries, I feel like you have to have that charge and that drive to do it.
Yeah, you need it, because it's such a hard
and it's slog. It's a hard slog because there's so many people doing it. It's so oversaturated. Mm. I mean, lucratively, like we reap the rewards through delicious eating and drinking, but it's not necessarily a lucrative career like a lawyer or a engineer. So I just want to find out why people do what they do and what fuels their fire.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the journalist in me. It's like, what? I just want to know why.
I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, so good. And now it's time for Whiskey Business.
Whiskey Business.
Yes. The game that is positively bulging with tough choices and difficult questions.
Yes.
Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
As an aside, is bulging an appropriate food word?
I've used bulging before.
Oh, fantastic. In what context?
Ice cream.
Ah.
Bulging. Scoop of ice cream bulging through that pudding.
We'll get it back on track.
Okay, back on track.
On a Saturday morning, are you choosing a plain or an almond croissant?
Almond croissant?
Mm.
Yes. I love a good almond croissant, but I also appreciate a very well-made plain croissant because then I can put jam in it.
Oh, yeah. How do you feel about the ham and cheese?
I enjoy it. Mm. I'm not.
I don't love it.
You know what? You don't love it? Mm. Okay. I feel like it's not, I wouldn't seek out it, but I know that other people have certainly had it. And if like Luke orders one, I'm definitely asking for a bite.
Mm.
But it's not like I'd choose that as a lunch option or something.
Yes. I always find myself ever so slightly disappointed with a croissant, just a plain one.
Okay.
I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm just being too harsh.
That's okay. There's nothing wrong with being harsh. I'm a critic. I feel like sometimes you have to be critical.
Is plain or salt and vinegar the superior potato chip?
Salt and vinegar. Superior. But I can appreciate the plain.
Mm.
I'm going to go salt and vinegar for this one, just purely to answer the question.
Yes.
To make a choice.
Yeah, you've got to make a choice. Crinkle cut or smooth?
Smooth, chicken flavored.
Oh, like you know those, chicken. Chicken's underrated, I think.
It's underrated, but remember those thin ones? Those thin, like the crisps with the chicken flavor on top? Mm-hmm. I appreciate them in that. Oh, the phone's gone.
Oh, we've rabbited on for too long.
So I appreciate that. But with crinkle cut, I really enjoy, like salt and vinegar or like a plain chip for crinkle cut. Because the thin ones just go too quickly.
They do. And if you're having chips with dip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love them. You got to warm them up in the oven though. And
the chips or the dip?
The chips. Have you tried that before?
This is the first time I've heard of this.
This is an ultimate hack, and we can bougie it out too. So if you want to be a little bit fancy, I've got the ultimate hack for you. Get some plain potato chips or salt and vinegar, a dealer's choice.
Mm-hmm.
Put them on a tray, put them in the oven, let them warm, bring them out of the oven, and then serve it with a tarama, so white tarama salata, which is like a cod roe dip.
Mm-hmm.
You can get them at great Greek grocers or really good grocers in Melbourne. And if you want to bougie it up, just put some Yarra Valley caviar pearls on top of the tarama and have that as your snack. Bring that out at your next dinner party and that will go.
That's impressive.
Forget the celeriac and the cauliflower. This will go.
I've never thought of that.
Yeah. A warmed potato chip.
A warm potato
is
chip.
One of those things that you haven't unlocked in your mind yet.
Mm.
So good.
Mind is blown.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I know. My mind was blown too learned that.
Where did you learn that from?
I think a chef told me that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Huh.
I know. It's a good hack.
It is. Single coat or a double coat, Tim Tam?
Double.
Oh, good.
Always.
Always.
I mean, I love texture, so we need that crunch. Give me crunch.
And if you're going to a traditional Australian country bakery, are you choosing the vanilla slice or the chocolate eclair?
I was going to say the Neenish tart because that's not an option.
Oh, a third option. Yeah, you can go with that.
I love a Neenish tart. Probably the vanilla slice.
Okay.
Yeah.
On Neenish tart though,
mm-hmm.
I was actually having a conversation with a friend about this because she sent me a photo of this cracking looking Neenish tart from a country bakery.
Mm-hmm.
She really enjoys mock cream.
Oh, the faux cream.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? It's a big no from me.
Big no. You can definitely tell like that it's fake and artificial.
Which I think is the point, but...
Like, because you would have it in a eclair, right? It would be in the... Because with the Neenish tart, wouldn't it be more marshmallowy instead of the... Or is that what you mean?
The one that my friend had.
Oh, the
icing cream. No, not the top. It was filled with mock cream. Oh. And I said, I can't get around this. I'm sorry.
Oh.
But I've had eclairs that have the mock cream in it as well. I'm all for fresh. I need the fresh. But
you can't compare with fresh. Like, fresh is just the king.
I don't even know what mock cream is made of.
I'm going to look into that. Maybe it's icing sugar. Nah, can't be icing sugar.
No, that would taste good.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going to research this. I'm going to find out what it's made out of.
The history of mock cream.
Fresh is best. I don't think I could enjoy it as much as the original.
No, agreed.
Yes.
Finally, you're planning your perfect high tea.
Mm-hmm.
Three dishes and three guests. What are you serving and who's coming? Alive, dead or fictional? Just a really easy question.
Wow. Easiest question there is. Oh, gosh. Do we start with the people?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're starting with the people. Three people, alive or dead.
Or fictional.
Or fictional.
So you can go with the theme, which others have found easier.
Oh, so you start with the theme and then you choose the people.
Yeah.
Goodness, what's it going to be? Because then it's like the baking theme too. Maybe we do... It's the savory high tea.
Mm.
We do a savory high tea and we are inviting. We're going to invite someone a little bit crazy. So let's just go Heston Blumenthal.
Oh, yes.
Because he's a little bit wacky in the kitchen.
He is.
So we're bringing Heston. We are going to bring, oh my goodness, I don't know.
I know, this is a challenging question.
Let's just say Nigella for Nigella's sake because she's an absolute queen.
Yes.
I need someone that's non-foodie now. You know what? I'm actually gonna say Eminem.
That's from left field.
So left field. Just because I couldn't think of anyone else. No, and
that's often the best thing.
And I'm a bit of a old school hip hop kind of gal.
Ah.
So he was in front of mine because I thought you might ask me about what I listened to.
Music. Yes. Yeah. No, I mixed it up.
Yeah. So yeah, why not? Okay. So this is going to be a really interesting dinner.
Yeah.
And what are we eating? Mm. What am I baking? So I've got three bakes to prepare for this ultimate dinner.
Yes.
Okay.
Or yes, high tea.
High tea, sorry.
It could be a dinner.
High tea.
We can do entree, main, dessert if you want.
Entree, main, dessert. Okay. Well, we're starting with the entree and maybe we do gorgeous, comté gorgeous.
Oh.
I mean, I'm going to try and make it.
Yeah, fantastic.
Might have to get Nigella to tap in and help out. But I love a savory choux pastry and comté is elite.
Yes.
So that'll be the entree.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we need to mix it up with something a little bit fresh and fun.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some seafood to have the main.
Mm-hmm.
But also just some really like elite seafood, kind of like a smoked octopus.
Ooh.
Maybe we get some tarama in there. Definitely chips, really hot chips, not fries, not potatoes, but just a nice in-between chip, bright, zesty salad made with gorgeous Aussie produce, maybe a little bit of native stuff thrown in there like finger limes or something. Oh, punchy.
Yum, yes.
And pops. And then dessert. Let's just go with the apple pie.
Yes. Oh, what a way to bring it home.
Yeah, we're going full circle.
Oh, I love it. Cara, thank you so much for being on Bakeology and indulging me with your incredible vocabulary. You've painted such a food picture and I've tried to keep up and couldn't possibly.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the pod and I'm happy to colour in the picture anytime.
Oh, it's incredible. Can we eat that pie now?
Yes, we can.
Oh my God.
Let's do it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, the impact of choosing just the right word to describe something is phenomenal. I swear I could taste almost everything we discussed without having a single bite. Except for, of course, the golden apple pie we devoured seconds after we stopped recording. Now you can find Cara on Instagram at CaraFoodWine and check out her website, CaraFoodWine.com. And for those of you in Australia, you can find Cara's weekly double-page spread, Kitchen Confidential, in the Herald Sun every Tuesday. And this week's recipe encapsulates our conversation in a single bake. It's my red wine poached pear and almond galette. With its classy classic flavours, striking looks, vibrant colours, and boozy leanings, this galette is a true showstopper. And you can find the recipe at whatsadambaking.com. And don't forget that if you enjoyed this episode as much as we did, please subscribe, share, and review, and check out Bakeology on Instagram at bakeology.podcast. That way you will not miss when the next episode drops with Vanessa Calafiore. And so until then, stay sweet and watch out for those soggy bottoms. Bottoms.
I love it.
Yeah. I was going to say, I feel like throbbing is another one that's been used, but then I feel like we're going down a different path.
Yes.